This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download over at our website, progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the Bush administration's assault on our civil liberties and what can be done about it. With me to discuss this issue is Barry Steinhardt, who was the ACLU's associate director for 10 years and now for the last six has been director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. Barry Steinhardt, welcome to Progressive Radio.
It's great to be here.
Say, did you come from a political family, or how'd you get interested in these kinds of issues?
Well, you know, I was actually an ACLU client when I was 13 years old.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, no, I was to be given the math prize for reasons that are sort of inexplicable, considering I'm not very good at math. And in my eighth grade graduation, it was public school in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and they wanted me to read a overtly religious poem, and I refused. I went to my rabbi at the time, and I, you know, when I know about civil liberties, I was sort of offended. And he called the ACLU, and they called the school board. And the school board said, "What?" You know, and so we won a little victory that day.
Did you read something else? And I was hooked. Did you read something else? And do you remember what that poem was?
I did read something else. I have no idea what it was.
And what was the original offending poem?
It was not only a religious poem, but it was a particular sect of Christianity, obscure sect. So it was offensive to essentially everyone in the school, something the teacher just wanted read. But I got hooked on civil liberties at that point.
But you didn't start working for the ACLU after eighth grade. Where'd you go first, and how'd you then arrive finally at the ACLU?
I was a member of the ACLU since I basically was a teenager, having been a client, sort of. I went to, after law school, I became director of the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, managed a couple of political campaigns, became director of the Vermont ACLU after that, and been around the ACLU now for 28 years.
You get a medal for that, don't you, or a gold watch?
You get some kind of watch. I don't think it's gold.
Do you really?
We can't afford the gold. You know?
We don't even do that at the Progressive.
It's a Timex.
Maybe a lifelong subscription to the Progressive we give people when they leave or something. But, and your parents, were they politically oriented or not necessarily?
Good liberal Democrats.
So tell me how drastic a change the Bush administration has marked versus things that were going on with Clinton.
Well, you know, the last 8 years have been characterized by an unrelenting assault on civil liberties. It's really, I can't say it's completely unprecedented, but it's certainly it is different in character than anything we've seen in a very long time. Unlike the Clinton administration, where, you know, we had our ups and downs in terms of civil liberties with President Clinton, but there were things he did that, we opposed. There were things he did that we supported. There have been no ups in the Bush administration. It has been one assault after another, and it's across the board. It's not one particular civil liberties issue. It's across the whole spectrum of the rights of Americans that we've seen that assault.
And has this come from Bush himself, or was it from the Attorney General's office, or do you think it's Cheney and Addington who've been pushing this more than anyone?
Well, you know, I'm not enough of an aficionado to know exactly who's in charge in the Bush administration, but I can tell you that the entire Bush administration reflects the anti-civil liberties agenda and bias. It's hard to think of an exception to that.
And have you and your colleagues felt overwhelmed given the magnitude of this assault?
Well, you know, it's a little like fighting a thousand-front war. At times you don't know where to start. But we try to keep up the good work, and we certainly are looking forward now to January 20th, 2009, in the hopes that no matter who's elected president, that we can turn over a new leaf.
What is McCain's record on civil liberties? Is he much of a hope?
Well, I should start by saying, of course, the ACLU is a relentlessly nonpartisan organization. We have no dog in this fight. We do not endorse any candidates. We have written about the civil liberties records of both Senator McCain and Senator Obama. Both, I think it's fair to say, are mixed. There's some things with which we agree, some things which we disagree. We're hopeful that if it comes to a McCain administration, we will not see the same relentless assault and hostility to liberty that we saw in the Bush administration.
I know Obama taught constitutional law, and he has said that though he voted, to my mind, unconscionably for the FISA bill, he has said that he would, as a first task, assign his attorney general to examine all the executive orders that the Bush administration has brought forward to see what can be done about them. What can be done about them?
Well, a lot. One of the things that I've been doing recently for the ACLU is coordinating a project to look at all of the opportunities that the new president will have to turn back the clock on the Bush administration, to move liberties back to where they were 8 years ago, or to move them forward. And it's an extraordinary list of things. It's across the board. And some of them are, sort of self-evident to civil libertarians, close Guantanamo and extraordinary rendition, those sorts of things. But a lot of things like, investigating whether or not there were crimes that were committed in the warrantless wiretapping program, ending the warrantless wiretapping program, and some things that are fairly obscure to most people. So we're preparing a document that lists all of those things, and it runs many tens of pages.
Barry Stoner, give me a clue as to one of the obscure things.
Well, I'll give you an example. Really kind of a tragedy out there. Women who live in public housing and who are the victims of domestic violence. A few years ago, the Bush administration changed this policy so that anyone who lived in a house, who lived in a public housing unit where crime was committed, was kicked out of that public housing unit. Now, the consequence was that the victims in this case, the women who had been battered, were being kicked out of public housing. Now, the Congress in the Violence Against Women Act overturned that and ordered the Bush administration not to do that anymore. That was almost 3 years ago. The Bush administration still has not issued the regulations that provide for that, even despite the direct congressional mandate.
I thought they were supposed to execute the laws of the land.
Well, that's part of what happens when you have a president who assumes these imperial powers. That president tends to forget the oath of office to faithfully execute the laws of the land.
And from a procedural standpoint, what does it take to overturn an executive order?
Well, it depends on the order. Some things are nothing really much more than the stroke of the president's pen. Some actually require issuance of new regulations, which can be a little time-consuming. You have to go under what's known as the Code of Federal Regulations. There's a procedure for that. That could take a few months.
But that's like you give 30-day notice. But then
30-day notice,
you can go ahead
comment.
And do it, though, can't you?
Yeah, but there's a lot of things. I mean, one thing that it's now been changed twice, and we're hoping for a third time, what's known as the abortion gag rule, the prohibition on U.S. foreign aid being used for any family planning where abortion is even mentioned. That's what's known as the Mexico City rule. The Clinton administration came in and undid and said that we're not going to do that. Bush reversed it. Well, the next president can reverse it again, and he can do that by a stroke of a pen.
And both of them did it on their first days.
Both of them did it on their first days, yeah.
Now, there is a guy running for president who has worked for and with the ACLU closely, and I'm not talking about Ralph Nader or Cynthia McKinney here. It's Bob Barr, who has kind of an odd trajectory before he got to the ACLU. Tell me how well you know him, what you know about him.
Well, I know Congressman Barr fairly well. I'm one of the people who worked with him. And again, despite the fact Congressman Barr was a consultant to the ACLU, and a number of us work with him, we're not supporting him. We're not supporting any of the candidates. He's got a strong record on civil liberties issues. We're glad that he's raising those issues in the campaign. He was a strong voice for civil liberties.
Was it a surprise to you, Barry Stoner, that he arrived at the ACLU's doorstep?
Well, we've got a lot of strange bedfellows. Congressman Barr, of course, was a Republican for became a libertarian. He's kind of a libertarian Republican. There were a lot of issues in which he disagreed with us, and I think still disagrees with the ACLU. But he felt very, very strongly about a lot of civil liberties issues, particularly issues of government surveillance and freedom from government, wiretapping, and that sort of thing. Once it became clear that then Congressman Barr had those views, we worked with him pretty closely.
And has he been under assault by his former or erstwhile colleagues in the Republican Party not to be running?
Well, I couldn't tell you that. This has not, however, been an election where we've heard much about any candidate being a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
No, it may come up yet, though.
Including Congressman Barr. I'm not even sure if he is, but...
To your mind, what's been the most egregious assault by the Bush administration on our civil liberties?
You know, I find it's a very difficult question to answer. There are so many to choose from, but I think that it has been the way and probably the way in which the intelligence agencies have been turned inward on Americans. Whether it's not just the NSA spying program, but it's spying on political protesters. That is a frightening long-term development.
I mean, this has been going on all up and down the chain of law enforcement. By that, I mean NSA, FBI, Pentagon, all the way down to, state police, county sheriffs, municipal police, sometimes college campus police officers. That's what's so extraordinary to me.
Well, it is. And, there's a larger issue, of course, which is we're moving towards a surveillance society in the United States where our every movement, our every action, our every utterance, all our transactions are being tracked, recorded. But the bleeding edge of that is the way in which we treat both political dissenters and unfavored minority groups. And so, yes, we've seen this sort of spying on people up and down the chain, and it goes beyond spying. We're talking about people who have been arrested, people who have been prevented from traveling. We have clients, who tried a businessman from the Midwest who tried to travel into Canada and got was shackled in front of his family
for hours,
because he was on the so-called no-fly list.
And a lot of these people, you said unfavored minorities. We're talking about Muslim Americans and Arab Americans,
yes,
largely.
That's right. Muslims, Americans, Arab Americans, South Asian Americans, yes, are the most unfavored group when it comes to this sort of repressive measures.
Yeah, I talked to an Arab American guy either from Detroit or from I think he was from Ohio, who was a firefighter for 10 or 11 years, and five or six times he'd go over the border to Toronto to visit his family, his wife's family. And on the way back, he was almost invariably stopped and humiliated and handcuffed and detained for hours at a time. And I mean, maybe once, but five or six times.
And you look at people like, if you know the story, Brandon Mayfield is a lawyer in Oregon, who's actually a Muslim. He was arrested. There was because one of the London bombings, the FBI supposedly found his fingerprints in a safe house. Now, that turned out to be a mistake. But he was arrested, thrown into solitary confinement, told he was going to be subjected to execution, kept there for a very long period of time, even after the European police made it quite clear that the fingerprint identification was wrong. The U.S. government kept insisting he was the guy. But Mayfield is sort of the ultimate example of what can happen. This innocent American who got caught up in this web of suspicion and mistake.
And he finally got a settlement, a couple $1 million.
He finally did, which is a good thing. But I'm not sure it really is adequate compensation for what happened to him.
No, hardly. Barry Steinhardt is my guest today. He is the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Some of the apparatus for this kind of police spying is the Joint Terrorism task forces. I know they've been doing it. And then another thing called fusion centers. Right. Are those one and the same thing? Are they different things? What are they?
No, they are different things, actually. The Joint Terrorism Task Forces are essentially federal, state police efforts, combined efforts. The fusion centers are an interesting lot. There are a couple dozen of them right now. They vary in size and complexity. Essentially, what they are is attempts to bring together lots of information about people and to engage in various kinds of intelligence. They are, but as I say, they're a bit of a mixed bag out there. But what has happened over the over the past few years is that the federal government, particularly the Department of Homeland Security, has made enormous sums of money available to state and local governments for anti-terrorism work. Some of it almost laughable when you think about the idea that, you know, anti-terrorism money is going to some small town in Iowa, where there's the chances of a terrorist showing up pretty slim. But we're talking about a lot of money here. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been available. The fusion centers are all funded by the federal government.
Part of the fusion centers that concerns me has to do with the involvement of the private sector. One thing that I've been looking at over the last several years is increasingly the Bush administration has tried to conscript members of the private sector, and some members of the private sector didn't need conscripting, would happily go into the lap of the government and while there invade people's privacy. But there are kind of institutional setups within, I think, fusion centers themselves that invite the participation of the private sector.
Yeah, we did a report a couple of years ago on what we call the surveillance industrial complex. The government, when it can't obtain data itself, private data, private information itself, simply buys it or, as you say, conscripts the private sector to provide it with that data. It's often very hard to tell where the government ends and the private sector begins, particularly in the Bush administration where they rely so heavily on contractors frequently you go to a sub-agency of the Department of Homeland Security and a very high percentage of the people who appear to be the workers there are actually contractors. So there's this very close nexus now between the private sector and the government. And some of it is nothing much more than a pork barrel.
But on the other hand, some of it might be a little more nefarious than that. You know, a while ago there was the TIPS program balloon that got punctured finally, but this was an effort by Admiral Poindexter, of all people, who was discredited and convicted during the Iran-Contra affair.
Yeah, actually, I think you're talking about the Total Information Awareness.
Total Information Awareness Program. But that had to be discarded. So I think the casual observer would say, well, it's not a problem anymore, but it's still a problem.
Oh, no, actually, Total Information Awareness was a program that we worked on very hard. We take some credit, I think, deservedly so, for its apparent demise. Now, what do I mean by apparent demise? The Total Information Awareness Program, the idea was it was based in DARPA, which is the Defense Department's research arm, and Admiral Poindexter, you say, of Iran-Contra infamy, was the head of this program. It was his brainchild. And his idea was that you gathered all of this, the strands of our lives together, both from the public sector and the private sector, and you analyzed all that and you tried to pick out the bad guys, the terrorists. A remarkable thing about that program, of course, was that you could actually, not that it would work, but rather because it's very, very difficult to find terrorists sort of by finding a needle in a haystack by putting more hay on the stack, which is what the Admiral proposed to do. But the fact is he could have built it. I mean, all that data is out there. The computing power has advanced to the point now where you could build it, and they were on their way to building it. Now, the Congress shut it down, sort of. The Congress said that the Total Information Awareness Program was shut down. They passed a semi-secret protocol to the legislation that said that portions of it relating to foreign persons could be in the black budget of the Pentagon, basically the intelligence agencies. We now know that not only does that exist within intelligence agencies? But they essentially have recreated the Total Information Awareness Program and have a relationship with domestic law enforcement as well. So you can go to the ACLU website and ACLU.org/privacy, and we've got a graphic there to show you exactly how that works.
Well, that's not very comforting, I've got to
no,
say.
No, the founder of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin, used to say that no civil liberties battle ever stays won. This one didn't stay won for more than about 3 years.
Now, with more of this private sector stuff going on, I wrote an article for The Progressive on InfraGuard, which is a group of 26,000 business people around the country who are hooked up with their local and statewide FBI officers. One officer deals with the private sector members in each major city or in the state. And they also are supposed to be reporting back to the FBI suspicious things that they see. How tricky is that outfit, InfraGuard?
Well, there's a lot of this informal, sometimes formal deputizing of the private sector. And it runs across the board. I mean, I'll give you another example. Most Americans, I don't think, are aware of this. It's what's known as the suspicious activity reporting. Basically, banks are required to report transactions of a particular size to a federal financial center known as FinCEN, which literally has millions of these transactions. And that's actually, if you recall Elliot Spitzer and how they found Elliot Spitzer's records, it was through the suspicious activity reporting. But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of this kind of deputizing of the private sector, both to provide information to the government, as well as to enforce the government's rules. One of the things that I don't think most Americans know about until they get hit on the backside by it are the lists that go out to financial institutions like banks of suspicious persons. There are countless Americans who've gone in to open a bank account. Innocent Americans, never did anything wrong. Going in to open a bank account, go get a mortgage. You can get a mortgage, only to be told that no, the bank can't do business with them because they're on the list.
Now, this is a kind of a blacklist, but
it's absolutely a blacklist, and these blacklists that the government run are so riddled with error.
How do you get on a blacklist, and how do you get off?
Well, it's easier to get on than to get off. there's a variety of different versions of these blacklists, but basically an intelligence or law enforcement agency nominates a name to go on the blacklist. The problem is there's a lot of people out there with similar names.
There's the no-fly list. You can see the justification for it, even though they now put a million people on it or something. But to have a blacklist for that same person who's never been convicted of a crime, that person can't get a mortgage, that seems way beyond justification.
One would think so, but that's the reality in which we live, and it's getting to be more and more common. We're developing these lists of outliers that somehow we try to keep out of society, and aside from the obvious problems of discrimination, these lists are so riddled with error that they're just sweeping in hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Now, Barry Steinhardt, you're the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. There's some technological problems out there, leaving aside whoever is president, forgetting about Bush, Cheney for a while. What degree of privacy do we have in this day and age of the internet and the computer and all these electronic and computer-based files?
Well, there's a famous quote from Scott McNeely, the former CEO of Sun Microsystems: "There is no more privacy. Get over it." I think McNeely is not right. Privacy. The way I look at it, privacy is kind of on life support right now. The relentless march of technology, particularly of technology, and it's not just individual technologies, RFID chips or video surveillance cameras, that sort of thing, but it's the whole combination of technologies and particularly the way they're tied together by big databases, certainly threatens our privacy, but it's not dead yet. It's close, but it's not dead yet, and we can still save it, but it's going to take heroic measures to do that.
And who are some of your allies in Congress that you can rely on for some of these heroic measures?
Well, they of course cut across the political spectrum, and it's also of course vary issue by issue. But often some of our allies, that most people would think of as strange bedfellows for the ACLU, kind of conservative Republicans, don't agree with us a lot of issues, but do on this set of issues. But, there are some real champions in the Congress on privacy issues. Congressman Markey from Massachusetts, Senator Leahy from Vermont, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. There are a number of allies. But we're a long way from getting the Congress to take privacy seriously.
Are you surprised that the Democrats, once they got hold of Congress, didn't do more to protect our civil liberties and roll back some of the stuff?
Well, we've been around for 87 years now. And one of the things we learned in that 87 years, the ACLU, is that civil liberties aren't a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. And even people you think are going to be your friends are often going to disappoint you. Hopefully we weren't naive enough to believe that a sudden change in hands of the leadership of the Congress was going to make all the difference.
And how much of this is the fault of the American people themselves? I mean, I remember seeing polls after 9/11 where a frighteningly large plurality of people, somewhere, if my memory is correct, in the 25% to 30% range, didn't think people should be allowed to protest against the war or against the attacks against Afghanistan.
Well, the protection of civil liberties has always been the protection of minorities, whether it's a political minority or a racial minority, an ethnic minority. So we don't decide what your rights are in this country based on a majority vote. We have some core principles.
But we may need a majority to defend them.
Well, yes, we may need a majority to defend them in some cases. But if you look kind of at the arc of history here, I I've been in the ACLU a long time. One of the things I did earlier job in the ACLU was I went through the papers of Roger Baldwin, who was our founder back in 1921. And what was sort of remarkable in going through all those papers was how limited the table was in those days. I mean, basically, the ACLU, I think, can take great credit for the fact that we now have free speech rights in America, for example. But the notion of women's rights or gay rights, those things were not even on the radar screen. And some of those things were just bubbling up. We've come a long way in those 87 years. It's been a bumpy ride. But if you look at the arc of history, I think that it's on our side.
That's the old Martin Luther King line, that the arc of history bends toward justice. In the less than a minute that we have left, Barry Steinhardt, for our listeners who are interested in the ACLU or interested in finding out how to fight back to protect our civil liberties, where would you advise them to go and what should they do?
Well, the easiest place to go, of course, is ACLU.org. Just type in ACLU pretty much in your computer, you'll get there. We certainly welcome members. And you can join easily enough right at our website. If you join the national ACLU, you also become a member of your local ACLU, for example, here in Wisconsin.
There are state chapters that you can find your state chapter and your local chapter by going to the website. And I think you look at the bottom of that homepage to click on your state chapter. I go there often doing reporting. I need to talk to the local director.
That's exactly right. We have an office in every state union.
So that's all the time we have left today. Barry Steinhardt, I want to thank you for being my guest. Barry Steinhardt, director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. Thanks again, Barry.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.